Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to Bugle episode 122, sub-episode Gamma. I am Andy Zaltzman, and I have the paperwork to prove that. By the time you hear this, I'll be about to start my record-breaking run at the Edinburgh Festival. But you probably know that already by virtue of having spent so much time booking your tickets for it. John Oliver, meanwhile, still lodging at Upstate Side, building up some more celebrity stories to regale us with for when we come back with the real Bugle in a couple of weeks, like how he rode a Galapagos turtle all the way up the Grand Canyon with Woody Harrelson and Billie Jean King, or how he teamed up with Diana Ross, the late Casper Weinberger, Joe Torre and Chelsea Clinton to record an Uzbek version of the soundtrack of the 80s hit movie Gremlins, or how he's got Condoleezza Rice chained to a radiator in his dungeon in New York. But instead of a real Bugle, here is part three of the official Bugle History of the World, 2007 to 2009. And this instalment deals with January to June of 2009. And as 2008 ticked over into 2009, the world made its New Year resolutions. And the Israeli military's resolution was to try really hard to launch more ground invasions of Gaza to back up the airstrikes it had bought itself for a post-Christmas treat in the sales. And unusually for resolutions, they really meant it. And they really acted on it.
Top story this week, and Happy New Year to the Middle East. And for the thousandth year in a row, that sounds sarcastic. Congratulations, Middle East. It is your depressing four-figure anniversary. Half-inflated balloons should be cascading from the ceiling in celebration now before sagging onto the floor like broken dreams. Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Of course old acquaintances shouldn't be forgot, Andy. Old acquaintances should be painfully raked over and used as an excuse for present-day atrocities. That's the little-known eighth verse of Auld Lang Syne. People tend to skip it when they're drunkenly group singing. It's less catchy, and it can really bring down a hootenanny.
What a finer way for the Middle East to celebrate Christmas than with a good old-fashioned family argument. I mean, you know, it's essentially what this is. And we've all had them, John, just not quite this big. There was one year when my parents blockaded me in my bedroom for 18 months, and I have to say, I was pretty knocked with them.
If you'd had rockets, you'd have fired them, wouldn't you?
Oh, I would.
Yes, the most badly behaved region on Earth once again chose to celebrate the New Year in signature style by sashaying up to the brink of all-out war. Not for them the oohs and ahs of fireworks displays. They prefer the oohs, the oh gods, and the please make it stops of genuine rocket attacks. I'm not sure when the last genuinely happy New Year in the Middle East was, Andy, but I think we're going back to before the British started exterior designing there, that's for sure.
I think you're probably going back to naught BC, aren't you, when a lot of these problems really kicked into hyperdrive. So far, the United Nations reaction to the crisis has been to begin work on a new limerick about the Middle East. It goes, there once lived in the Middle East a man who ate nothing but yeast. He continued to rise until, to his surprise, he was baked and eaten by a beast. And, you know, they're still working on that last line in particular, and it doesn't quite scan, but, you know, when it comes to the Middle East, it's so hard to reach compromise.
That's a strong message from the international community. Yeah. But just for once, Andy, it would be nice if they could take inspiration from that incredible moment during the First World War in 1914, when, on Christmas Eve, soldiers from both sides ventured into no man's land to play football together, before continuing to slaughter each other for another 4 years. But wouldn't it have been wonderful if the Israelis and the Palestinians on New Year's Eve had met on the border of the Gaza Strip and just sat down for a game of Scrabble? Yes, there would likely be some arguments about putting down a triple word occupier when it wasn't your go. I don't know.
Oh, yeah, there'd probably be arguments about what alphabet to use as well.
It's a bad idea. It just goes to show how complicated this issue is. If the Palestinians and the Jews have one thing in common, Andy, it's that they both struggle to summon up much of a Christmas spirit around this time of year. Now, you can say that that's because neither of them celebrate Christmas, but you don't need to believe in Santa to want to dress up like him.
Stop quoting Aristotle at this early stage of the podcast. The Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas has called for an honourable truce, and that could be a tough one, John. I mean, the truce itself is looking like a bit of a long shot, and an honourable one at the moment is looking about as likely as a portion of Peking duck winning the Olympic giant slalom next year.
Not impossible, but unlikely.
Yeah.
This current outbreak of madness came as an Egyptian-brokered six-month truce ran out on the 19th of December. And though that needn't have meant immediate breakdown, somehow you knew it would. It's like the warranty on a fridge expiring. Yes, it might just be 24 hours later, and your fridge may have been working perfectly well yesterday, but deep down you know that fridge is going to explode. And now France have been trying to negotiate a 48-hour ceasefire. 48... That is aiming low. Even this 48-hour proposal failed. Ehud Olmert rejected the proposal, saying conditions were not right for a ceasefire. What conditions is he talking about, Andy? Would those be the conditions of whether he wants a ceasefire or not? Call me an old-fashioned hippie, but any time is a good time for a ceasefire, being as how it ceases people from firing things.
Also, Sarkozy, the French president, he said it is France's duty to look everywhere for the roadmap towards peace. Right. And there's a problem with roadmaps to peace, John. They are always in the last place you look. Also, previous roadmaps have proved to be cartographically inept. And, in fact, I once borrowed a roadmap off a guy who'd been involved in the Middle East peace process. And I was trying to drive from London to see my parents in Tunbridge Wells, about 30 miles away. And I ended up parked outside a hardware store near Beirut, firing a water pistol at a school bus. They should try GPS towards peace, although that would probably even worse because they cease to take responsibility for where they're going.
The Gaza Strip has continued its unique position of being both the most and the least desired real estate on the planet. You think it's hard shifting a property in the current climate? Try shifting a three-bedroom anywhere within a rocket's flight of Gaza. It is, to put it offensively mildly, a buyer's market.
Well, it's a lively area, ripe for renovation, you know, characterful, bustling community.
That's right, big nightlife. Hamas leaders have urged Palestinians to observe a day of wrath after 7 days of violence in Gaza. Well done. We could add that to the pile of helpful responses to this situation. The only hope is that they misspoke, Andy, and they actually wanted to declare a day of thunder in response, that being a day when everyone watches non-stop showings of the Tom Cruise, Nicole Kidman stock car classic Days of Thunder.
I thought
good,
it was...
Good movie.
Oh, really? I'll take your word for that one, John.
Yeah.
As someone who's been in a good movie.
You haven't seen it! You haven't seen it! Don't judge on the almost universal critical panning. Don't judge on that, Andy.
When I do get to see John, which is, you know, disappointingly rare these days, I'd just like to be able to look you in the eye. I was hoping I'd get a copy for Christmas, but...
Yeah, you kept pulling Horace away from me. Come away, boy. Come away.
January 2009 was the 97th and last month that could claim it had hosted George W. Bush as president. And as he made his preparations for his presidential afterlife, the clock was ticking down to the biggest worldwide communal sigh of relief since Lyndon Johnson withdrew his threat to moon Leonid Brezhnev's wife, just to see the look on her face.
Well, Andy, America is about to swear in its 44th president. By the time this bugle goes out, it will be a matter of hours until the most historic day in the history of America goes down in history books for the rest of, time. That's it, for the rest of time. Are people getting carried away here, Andy? Yes. Are they setting themselves up for inevitable disappointment? Yes. Are they aware of that quite yet? Absolutely not. Now, as we were talking last week, the inauguration itself has taken a great deal of planning, but that pales into insignificance when placed to the actual transition of power. Obama's transition team will have been working solidly for over 6 weeks since the election to make the change as seamless as possible. And it can't have been easy with this particular administration. It's like exchanging the baton in a sprint relay race. You don't want anything to go wrong, but it's especially difficult when the person who's supposed to be handing it over to you is veering all over the place, running out of his lane, looking like he's going to drop it as he comes to the end of two of the worst run legs in presidential relay metaphor history.
Are they going to make him piss in a bottle, John? I do hope so.
Traditionally, there have also been practical jokes played on the incoming administration. Clinton's outgoing transition team famously took all the W's off the White House computer keyboards. But, to give them credit, the Bush administration got their own back by destroying the country over the following 8 years. Who's laughing now, President 42?
I guess Bush's parting prank for Obama is, I don't know, the Middle East.
The $10 trillion debt?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, there's a few really good ones.
If anything, he's taken this tradition a little too seriously. So that's it. This is, of course, the last ever bugle in history to take place during a George W. Bush presidency. Or at least, well, let's not get over-optimistic about this. It's the last for at least 4 years to take place without a Bush in the White House. So 9 years late, the 21st century can at last begin properly. But I'm disappointed, John, as if Bush hasn't done enough damage to the world for one presidency. With just days left in office, my daughter has contracted chickenpox. And I blame George W. Bush for this. I mean, it was all going fine, and then you think, oh, well, she's probably going to get away with it, and then all of a sudden, scratchy, scratchy, I blame Bush. It's just, it sickens me.
I mean, do you have any actual intelligence there, Andy, linking Bush to the chicken pox?
Well, we had the television on the other day, and the news was on, and they had a little snippet from Bush's parting press conference the other day, and 2 days later, my daughter came out in spots.
Well, that's the smoking gun.
That's right.
That's more than we had going into Iraq.
Yeah.
Bush has been going on a press offensive this week to try and shape his legacy, appearing with Brit Hume on Fox News, Sean Hannity on Fox News, and with Larry King on CNN. I imagine Fox were very hurt about that last one. Apparently, in a tearful confrontation, Bush said that it meant nothing and that he was thinking about Fox the whole time he was with CNN. But Fox responded by screaming, "Oh, I don't want to hear all the sordid details," and apparently ran out of the room to throw up. In his final press conference, Bush showed the calculated and selective remorse that he's been road testing for the last couple of weeks. He admitted that standing under a banner saying mission accomplished was a mistake, which is like apologising for spelling someone's name wrong on the birthday cake you made them out of shit.
Did he not say in this press conference, use the words, "We've had fun," which I guess maybe he has a slightly different attitude towards fun than me. For me, fun is seeing how many oranges I can cram into a single small plastic bag. Or maybe seeing how people react when I offer them 20 quid for their dog. Or perhaps even dressing up like a hippo and pretending to ski down the stairs. But for others like George W. Bush, evidently fun is presiding over the most divisive presidency in history, engendering resentment across the globe, and overseeing the descent into economic annihilation. Yeah, we're all different, John, and I guess that's what George W. Bush has proven over these last 8 years.
Well, conversely, Obama's initial press conferences so far have had a strange atmosphere to them. He's answered questions, addressed journalists by their names politely and calmly, and has been forthcoming with policy issues. And the press corps, in turn, have just looked stunned. It's like they've developed Stockholm syndrome. They're just not used to someone talking to them like that. I'm not even convinced they actually like it. Bush's press conferences over the past 2 years have been a relentlessly vapid kabuki, presenting the illusion of information being conveyed. He's even become famous for calling journalists by nicknames in a pseudo-friendly gesture of complete professional contempt. I'm no great fan of the American press, Andy. I don't have posters of any of them up on my wall, and I own very few of their albums. But let's spare a thought for what they've been going through, because for 8 years, they've been treated like slightly irritating circus animals doing tricks for kibble, standing on their hind legs to make their bored ringmaster proud. You've got to wean them off this ill-treatment gradually. It's like coming up from a deep-sea diving expedition. If you come up too quickly, you get the bends. So, to help them with this transition, Obama's going to have to force himself to make glib comments based on their physical appearance. They can't just go cold turkey. It's too much of a shock to the system.
Can he not just sort of wean them onto one kind of standard, generalised nickname for them all, like sugar cakes or something?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, he's got to do something, because this is not an easy time for the press.
No, and he's got to do it quickly as well, or, you know, the bubble of optimism will burst pretty quickly.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be difficult for them to now have to make some pretense of actually doing their job.
And then, finally, it was over, and a new president moved into the White House. Can you remember who it was? Well, I'm not going to tell you, but you'll find the answer out in this next clip from Bugle issue 61.
Well, Andy, in years to come, tens of millions of people will say, "I was there." Most of them will be full of shit. Not me. It really was an incredible moment, and not one that I ever thought I'd witness, because not only was I doubtful that I would be an African-American president of the United States in my lifetime, but I was even more doubtful that if I ever did, I would somehow be allowed to be there as it happened. It did feel like being an extra in a big-budget blockbuster movie. It was as close as I felt to legitimately screaming out "Hail Caesar" and watching a Christian get fed to a lion. An estimated 2.5 million people gathered together in front of the Capitol building. The only real comparison in terms of scale is the Hajj, the Muslim pilgrimage to Mecca, in an analogy which was bound to make much of middle America a little bit nervous.
For me, John, it was obviously delighted to see Obama take the White House, but it was a bit like when England won the Rugby World Cup final in 2003.
Of course,
was
I was
it a bit like that. It
was a bit like that, John. Because of course I was pleased that England won it, but I think I was even more pleased that Australia lost it. And here it was great to see Obama being inaugurated, but it was even better to see George W. Bush leave.
Well, the goodwill in the crowd was so strong, possibly because of that, that there were no reported arrests. Zero. None. That is absolutely astounding. Bear in mind that British people can't gather in a 15,000-seater football stadium without getting drunk and fighting each other. It just felt weird to be amongst an almost dangerous amount of people and feel completely safe.
No arrests at all, not even Cheney.
No, they were especially not Cheney. As we stood together afterwards, it hadn't really sunk in until Bush's helicopter, Marine One, flew directly over our heads and away from the White House, and it was like you could almost feel the collective sigh of relief make its way down the mall. Because, although there's great excitement at the possibility that Obama represents, I think there's just as much a sense of joy that the Bush administration is now gone. The first photos of Obama behind the desk in the Oval Office were remarkable, not just because of who he was, but because of who he wasn't. I even felt some relief seeing McCain sit there, as long as Palin wasn't behind him with a hammer.
It was obviously an amazing moment when Bush left in his helicopter to the cheers of the crowd. And in fact, I was thinking of this from the aerial shots, John, from the way the crowds were gathered around the Capitol building and then stretched down the National Mall. As Bush, the ex-president, God, that feels good, looked down from his special chopper. The crowd must have looked, the way they were gathered around the White House and stretched it down the mall, must have looked a bit like a giant hand flipping him one final farewell bird. A 2.5 million-person bird. Yeah, it's a shame they couldn't have done something like they do at football matches or Olympic opening ceremonies when the crowd turns over bits of card and makes a picture of a flag or Olympic rings or a wildebeest eating a piano. It's a shame that the crowd at the inauguration couldn't have all turned over little cards to spell out, "F*** you, George, seriously, f*** you." And I think that's an opportunity missed that America will regret in future years.
And if there was any doubt in your mind about whether people were being a little bit hard on Bush and his legacy, he generously silenced any sympathetic support by using one of his final declarations to announce that from now on January the 18th, it will be called National Sanctity of Human Life Day. President, ex-president, God, that really does feel great, doesn't it? Ex-president Bush writes that all human life is a gift from our Creator that is unique and worthy of protection. On National Sanctity of Human Life Day, our country recognises each person, including every person waiting to be born, has a special place and purpose in this world. Oh, why not? With all the problems in America and the world, why not leave with a parting shot on people who might, for whatever reason, want or need an abortion? Looking back at his administration, the president made a case for being one committed to building a culture of life. Among the achievements of life he highlighted were vigorously promoting adoption and parental notification laws, opposing federal funding for abortions overseas, encouraging teen abstinence, and funding pregnancy programs. But of course, he was also very much pro-death in things like his foreign policy, his inaction during Katrina, his shameful underfunding of Walter Reed, and his God-taking commitment to the death penalty. But here's the thing, I don't want to get too angry about it, because the point is, it's over. It's over. Exactly that kind of shit. Is over.
It's just wonderful that for the first time in 8 years, people around the world can wake up without the first thing they say being, oh shit, George W. Bush is the most powerful man on the planet. I think getting up is going to take a lot less long. This could really boost world productivity. And it was amazing joy and emotion. It was quite inspiring to see on the faces of the people in Washington this potently symbolic day of transformation and almost the beginning of a new modern age. And I guess it's hard as a white British person to fully understand and relate to what black Americans must have felt. I guess, I mean, the closest I can think is what I would feel like if a second-generation lapsed Jewish classics graduate ever became England cricket captain. I mean, it must have been that strong.
Street vendors were there selling "I was there" laminated certificates, which you could hang around your neck. And I saw one person buy two of them for themselves, and one for, and I quote, "my auntie in Indiana." Now, that is a lovely gesture, but let's be honest, she can't have that. No, she could have a different one saying, "I wasn't there, but I know someone who was, and they bought me this." That would be fine. But otherwise, that certificate surely doesn't have the necessary authority to justify its $15 price tag.
Of the many things in Barack Obama's intray, the world financial f***down was perhaps the biggest. And in February here in Britain, some of Britain's top bankers made everything just fine again by saying sorry.
The former bosses of two of the biggest UK banking casualties have apologised profoundly and unreservedly for their bank's failure. Quick thing on that, Andy. It is their failure, not their bank's. It's a minor point, but it does feel like it's worth making. Their bank is an abstract concept, a building, a collection of disparate people's monies gathered together in a complicated investment scenario. They, however, are a very literal pair of arseholes.
Yeah, this apology, John, was not so much half-arsed as containing barely detectable traces of buttock. Some people thought they might have spotted some... Some people thought they might have spotted some slightly flabby, pimpled flesh that might have been a bit of an arse, but it turned out to have been a slice of grapefruit in a funny light. Well, as you said, John, Elton John, very wrong on this one. Sorry seems to be the hardest words he sang. The pop singer, Sister Sledge collaborator, astronaut, bottle historian and Keynesian economist.
Oh, come on, Andy, he's only four of those things.
Like so much of what Elton has had to say over the years, John, this has proved completely untrue. Other examples include when he said, Saturday night's all right for fighting. Untrue, it's actually very good for fighting, if you're into that kind of thing. In fact, most of the world's top championship boxing bouts do take place on Saturday nights to maximise TV revenue.
That is true.
And also in the 1980s song Nikita, he said, oh, Nikita, you will never know anything about my home. Of course, at that stage, Elton John clearly had not foreseen the mid-1990s documentary Tantrums and Tiaras, filmed by his partner David Furnish, which actually included quite candid scenes shot in Elton's own house.
He also said, I'm a rocket man, Andy, despite the fact that his feet have rudimentary jet propulsion.
But the point is, as you say, sorry was, in fact, quite an easy word to say. The difficult words to say turned out to be any that gave even the slightest hint that they even marginally meant it. Their apology, John, was a bit like a man who's just sliced your pet guinea pig in half with a hacksaw, apologising not for slicing your guinea pig in half with a hacksaw, but expressing regret that a sharp, serrated blade can adversely impact on guinea pig flesh when applied in a repetitive slicing motion.
Former Royal Bank of Scotland chief executive Sir Fred Goodwin said he could not be more sorry for what happened. The former bank chief also said that the bonus culture had contributed to the crisis and needed to be reviewed. Oh, no shit! Any more pearls of retrospective wisdom they'd like to throw our way? That's like the ex-mayor of Pompeii saying he felt their city had a volcano problem. We are currently covered in 60 foot of ash and pumice. I think now is the time to review our policy of being erupted on. In hindsight, it was a bad idea.
Yeah, bonus culture has been under attack, John. The bankers themselves have even admitted it has been a problem. And Prime Minister Gordon Brown has said that he is really cross about it. Really, really cross. And if they don't do something about it, he's going to have their guts for garters. Which, I should say, is different from what he said when he went to a French offal speciality restaurant last week when he said he would have their guts for starters. Thank you very much. I'm here all week. The culture of rewarding risk rather than good practice has taken hold of the banking world. And, John, this to me seems a bit like paying a surgeon more if he uses a chainsaw instead of a scalpel, because it looks cooler, makes more noise and generates more blood. And I guess, as Aristotle himself once said, if it ain't hurting, it ain't working. Although, to be fair to Aristotle, he did have a very unorthodox attitude to gherkin eating.
And to be really fair to him, he did never say that.
Well, he did believe that if you didn't stick your gherkin fork through the roof of your mouth, you wouldn't get any nutritional value from your pickle, and also might incur the wrath of Kornikos, the god of gherkins. Strange man. Clever, but strange. But the bankers have expressed concern, though, John, that if they're not paid enough, a lot of top bankers might leave the banking sector and go to work elsewhere, to which the obvious layman's response is, oh, good, problem solved. Right off, then. Let's get some orangutans in their places and see if they can bring a bit of stability to the situation. They couldn't get it more wrong, surely. They might smear bananas all over their computer screens and wank on their keyboards. But that's an expense that can be withstood if it means they don't gamble billions and billions of billions and billions of pounds on a fiscal hunch.
But at least they have come forward. That's all anyone really wants, Andy. They want a belated, semi-sincere apology. Oh, no, I'm sorry. They want their jobs and homes back. Yes, that's it. I got confused.
But you can't have everything, John.
No, you can only have one of those, otherwise that is exactly the kind of greed that got us into this mess. During the hearings, the Commons Select Committee asked aggressive questions, but were accused of not delivering a knockout blow. And I think that's because people are now angry enough to want to see actual physical violence break out. There wasn't a single person in that room who wouldn't have seriously benefited from a slap across the face.
But the bankers' apology did not surprisingly fix the global economy. So at the end of March, with world finance teetering about like a concussed stegosaurus in stiletto heels, the G20 were powdering their economic noses in preparation for their holy f***ing shit tour gig in London.
G20 now, and that's not the new name for Gatorade, nor is it the announcement of the end of a snooker break by ex-R&B star Warren G. G20. It's... Thank you, Andy. That laughter and applause means a great deal coming from you.
I'm tapping the cushion for that. I didn't look on that joke, but, you know, you've nailed it.
It's the Global Economic Summit, which is to be chaired by British Prime Minister Gordon Brown. The G20 is a group of the world's most powerful countries who collectively represent 85% of the world's economy. But, Andy, they're not happy sitting back with just that mere 85%. They're perfectionists, these capitalists. They won't rest until they make it a nice round 100%.
So the G20 will have to discuss big issues concerning the G20, ranging from should the G20 have a new logo, should they start the conference with a huddle, who's up some karaoke at the G20 leader's social later on, can the G20 get circle tickets for the latest West End show, DNA, a musical about Watson and Crick's discovery of DNA, should the G20 have a theme song, or even a uniform that all the leaders can wear to make them look like a team of heroes saving the world, maybe a cape, special hats and some shiny gloves. I guess once they've sorted that out, John, they can move on to AOB, which is basically questions such as exactly how f***ed is the world, A, very, or B, completely, and what's going to get us first, economic Ageddon or ecological Ageddon, and which, if either, should we do anything about? Big questions, John. Are there going to be big answers?
I think you're right. I think there needs to be a big start, Andy. They should, each member of the G20 should run through paper cut-out pictures of themselves, like at the start of the Super Bowl. From Germany, with a GDP of billions, Angela the Hammer Merkel! Y'all ready for this? And then she can spin on her head for a bit. Now, economics is a very dour subject area, if you understand. You need to zazz it up.
Yep, that's absolutely true.
And in fact, part of that zazzing, Gordon Brown has been on a 3-continent tour ahead of the summit next month. It's almost like he's on a movie press junket. He's having to sit in front of posters of the G20 and answer asinine questions about what's the funniest thing that's ever happened to him during an economic summit? And what was it like doing a love scene with Silvio Berlusconi? Following talks with UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon in New York, Mr. Brown said that at the G20 summit in London, doing nothing is no longer an option. When was that an option exactly? Who on earth had recommended that? Rather than attempt a solution, we should just collectively lie back and enjoy the financial sunset.
He also said, John, along the same lines, he said, I believe that now, for the first time, global leaders recognise the need to cooperate. Now, again, there must have been a few pointers from history suggesting that cooperation between leaders might be a good idea. For example, basically the entirety of human history. But I'm glad they have finally twigged. John, this is the biggest and most important gathering of world leaders in London since the Second World War. And for me, it's like a dry run for the Olympics in 2012.
Right.
Only with 20 world leaders crapping themselves at the state of the planet, rather than sport. And people waving banners against corporatised devastation of the world's poor, rather than banners encouraging volleyball players to play volleyball really well. I guess it's a fine line.
But, I mean, how is this message going down, Andy? Well, Czech Prime Minister Mirek Topolánek suggested the US recovery plans were the, and I quote, way to hell. I don't know if he means that in a good way, Andy. I mean, is there any way that way to hell can be seen as a compliment?
Oh, that could be a translation issue, that. I mean, he could be trying to say way to go. But the words for go and hell are very similar in Slovak.
That is an option. Or is hell perhaps a very fiscally responsible place? Now, the devil is notoriously allergic to running a substantial deficit. He's at heart a fiscal conservative.
Well, I guess, you know, he's got big energy bills. He's always had to balance the books. Yeah, some protesters have promised spectacular action, John, at the summit. So I'm guessing this involves somersaults, juggling, and maybe a motorcycle pyramid. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm looking for in spectacular action.
Yeah,
and, of course, the media are focused very much more on whether or not some windows will get smashed by some protesters,
yes,
rather than exactly what the world can do to fix the current mess. Lula, the Brazilian president who Brown met, coincidentally in Brazil, blamed the current crisis on the irrational behaviour of white people with blue eyes. And I guess he could cite a scientific research paper that came out last week which suggested that genetically white people with blue eyes are more predisposed to macroeconomic self-interest and short-termism. And interestingly, let's see, Steve McQueen was actually thought to have been involved setting up the IMF before he died. So there you go. I'm white with blue eyes, so I can only apologise to the world's developing nations for what I've done.
The International Monetary Fund, or IMF, to give them their abbreviated rap name, has suggested that a fiscal stimulus of at least 2% of GDP will be needed to counteract the effects of the slowdown. So will you join in with that, Andy? Will you pledge to spend 2% of your personal GDP on things that you don't really need to stimulate the economy?
Well, John, I've got a three-month-old baby, so we really do genuinely have quite a lot of gross domestic product. So I'm happy to contribute some of that. Some corporations in the City of London, John, are advising their staff to come into work in disguise next week, so that... or at least in the disguise of someone not wearing a suit, to try and confuse the anti-G20 protesters, or, as they're already being called, rioters. So I think, you know, this is quite good. They're going to dress down. They've even been given advice on how not to look like someone who's caused the global economic crisis. So, you know, the right kind of casual shoes to wear that makes it look like you're obviously not a banker dressing up to not look like a banker. But I think they should take it even further and go the whole disguised hog. Maybe you could go to work in a fat suit pretending to be ex-German Chancellor Helmut Kohl, or rent a horse outfit and pretend to be a horse, but not a police horse, because then the anti-capitalist horses will attack you. Up until May of last year, Britain had always been morally flawless, ethically incredible, and a corruption-free zone. Give or take the odd bout of empire building, slave trading, and stuff like that. But let's gloss over that. It was all about to change.
Andy, British politicians used to be world leaders in terms of sleaze, pumping someone who was their wife like a morally bankrupt traction engine, or being found dead, hanging upside down, naked, with an orange in their mouth. They used to be really good at it, but the UK has been rocked over the last fortnight by a series of expenses scandals, which have cost some MPs their jobs, many others their reputation. Now, this story has not made headlines around the world, largely due to the relatively small amount involved, but, Andy, it has lit up the UK press like a forest fire, hasn't it?
There has only been one story in town in Britain this week. One unending, interminable, tedious story. Political expenses. John, as if the country didn't have enough to worry about, what with massive recession, war in Afghanistan, and the fact that we don't have enough immigrants coming in anymore to do all our menial chores for us. It turns out... Wait a second, I can hardly bring myself to say this. It turns out that the system by which our MPs claim expenses is flawed.
It's
hard to know where we go as a nation from here in the current climate. But in a desperate effort to look cool, the Daily Telegraph newspaper scooped this story, the story that the entire nation here had been waiting for with not even slightly bated breath, the expose that we'd been completely off tenterhooks about, with the latest instalment of the ongoing expenses saga that has gripped this nation's attention like a dead worm grips a space shuttle. Because every day this week, John, the Daily Telegraph has been publishing leaked details of MPs and cabinet ministers' expense claims from all parties, including the prime ministers, revealing, John, that some of these MPs did play the system and made stupid, cocky or arrogant claims for things they clearly shouldn't have claimed for in the current climate, that others claim things they were legitimately entitled to under an admittedly flawed system but might have thought about passing on in the current climate. And also, and this is where it gets really heartbreaking, John, that some of them were so busy doing their jobs that they were elected for in the current climate that they made occasional minor mistakes filling in their expenses forms. And when alerted to these by the authorities, they rectified these mistakes and paid back any outstanding money. And that's the bit that really stings, John.
Yeah, I mean, that's what sticks in your throat. That's where you just completely lose your faith in all politicians, Andy.
Oh, they're not heroes.
Thank goodness for the Daily Telegraph, Andy, who have led the British public into battle like Queen Elizabeth I on a torpedo. The most controversial part of MPs' expenses has been the second home allowance, after it emerged that Tory MP Greg Barker made £320,000 on a flat he bought at the taxpayers' expense. And, you know, to be fair, that's a pretty good return, Andy. That's enough to make you want to be a career Tory MP, and there is literally nothing else that makes me want to do that. Other attention has been paid to Prime Minister Gordon Brown's £6,577 cleaning bill, which was paid to his brother. Gordon Brown argued that they shared a cleaner, and it was to reimburse him for costs. But surely the bigger question is, how the f*** is Gordon Brown getting his house so dirty? Is he blowing off steam at home after a frustrating day at work, failing to achieve anything and being loathed by the electorate who did not elect him, by just relaxing, smashing everything in his house and shitting up his own walls? Maybe someone should buy him a stress doll instead. It might save everyone a lot of money.
Yeah, well, I guess also the question is, why could he not just clean it himself, John? What else has he got on apart from stumbling cack-handedly from one disaster to the next, like Ricky Hatton's face into a Filipino's fist?
Too soon, Andy, too soon.
But these shocking revelations, John, have shaken the nation to the core of its 10,000-year-old soul. People have been just wandering, bleary-eyed around the street, scratching their heads, saying, what are we anymore? Who am I? Did I fight those two world wars for this? Did St. George conquer the Vikings and sink the Spanish Armada so our parliamentarians could play the margins of an extremely cack-brained system?
The key thing for politicians, Andy, is they've all been working on their excuses. Immigration Minister Phil Woolas has disputed any of the newspaper's allegations about him. He said that he's seeking legal advice over suggestions that he claimed for nappies and women's clothing. But the real question is, does he have the titanium balls to stand up and claim that they were legitimate personal business expenses? I stand before you and I say, I cannot get any real work done unless I'm dressed like a housewife and wearing a nappy. It is in the taxpayers' interest that they encourage my work rate. Some people work better in a double-breasted suit. For me, it's a floral pattern summer dress and a Pampers disposable.
Well, that wouldn't go down well, John, not in this environment-obsessed age. People would want to use recyclables, at least.
And that concludes part three of the official Bugle History of the World, 2007 to 2009. Now write up your notes and have them on my desk by 9 a.m. tomorrow, or else. I'll be back next week with part four, July to December 2009. Could Barack Obama cling to power? Would Gordon Brown have a sex change to try to win the looming general election? Could Leanne Rimes continue not to be involved with any illegal dogfighting rings? And would Kofi Annan reveal that it was he who was the man truly behind the Abraham Lincoln hit? Find out next week. Oh, and see you in Edinburgh. 4:20 at the Stand from Friday the 6th. Be lovely to catch up. I mean, I haven't had a chance to see you for ages, so be nice. Bye. And that goes for John, too. He would say bye if he wasn't voicing a new documentary about probiotic yogurts with Mel Gibson and Lindsay Lohan.